El Pacifico, Phil Hendry.
Hey, welcome, folks, back to the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. And if you want to know just how world-famous we is, are, go to our website, philhendryshow.com, and get a backstage pass and access all that that is the Phil Hendry Show website. We have close to 5,000 hours of archived material going back over a decade. Radio shows that we are rightfully proud of that, quite frankly, even surpass radio's understanding of itself. I'm being very honest now. We have a radio show that we've done that even radio people are scared of. But people like to listen to it. So go to our website at philhendryshow.com. With a backstage pass for a month, you get one free CD download, one free Best of Phil Hendry CD download from our shop. With a backstage pass of 6 months, you'll get three free Best of Phil Hendry CD downloads from our shop. And with a backstage pass of a year, you'll get five free CD downloads from our website. It's all there at philhendryshow.com. By the way, our podcast, which is available on iTunes, we have a new one today. It is Art Griego, and he wrote a book called The Art of Controlling People, and it's pretty, it's nuts.
What did he, is this the one where he's talking about snapping a dog's neck? My God.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Well,
oh, it's funny, is it?
Well, Art came on and said the way that he controlled his kids when they were young is he would say he would hold the Pomeranian dog that they had.
Is this going to make me angry?
Margaret, I don't know. And if I were you, I would just control my emotions.
Yeah, Margaret.
Fine.
In any event, he would hold the kids' Pomeranian dog in front of them and say, if you don't make your beds and clean up your room, I will snap the dog. I will snap the dog's neck.
Isn't that funny?
Actually, it was. And he never did snap the dog's neck, and that's what he did. But listen to it. It's our episode 82, the Phil Hendry podcast. Big news here in the city of Los Angeles. Negotiators reached an agreement late Tuesday to end an 8-day strike that crippled the twin ports of L.A. and Long Beach, the nation's largest ports complex, and prevented shippers from delivering billions of dollars in cargo to warehouses and distribution centers across the country. The mayor of L.A. said, Mayor Antonio Villagrosa, this was a strike that was costing about $1 billion a day. And when you talk about big ports, folks, and I'm sure many of you know this, some of you may not, I didn't, you're talking about billions of dollars a day. New Orleans, New York, Los Angeles, these are enormous ports of entry, if you will, to the United States, and there's a lot of stuff. And here at the El Pacifico, oftentimes as we are doing our broadcast or we are, you know, out and about doing our due diligence as entertainers and broadcasters, we oftentimes see, Bud, what do you see over there?
See a lot of car transports and everything.
I noticed that. Where are they going?
There's a lot of car transports that come in and out of Port Hueneme.
That's a real name, huh?
What is?
Port Hueneme? Yeah, it's a real name. You never heard of it? Yeah, I've heard of it. I thought they made it up.
Are you nuts or something? Port Hueneme is very, very real.
Port Hueneme is, yes. There is a Naval Construction Battalion base at Port Hueneme. It's right next to Point Magoo.
Now you gotta be kidding. I know about Port Hueneme.
Look it, man. Just because it's got a funny name doesn't mean it's made up, okay? Port Hueneme. Do you remember the movie There Will Be Blood?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. We'll build a pipeline. That's what we'll do.
Yes, that Daniel Plainview, he says, we'll build a pipeline. That's what we'll do all the way to Port Hueneme. Well, he was talking about the pipeline that they built to Port Hueneme.
Really? I thought he was talking about a pipeline that... I can't do it good.
A pipeline?
Yeah, you've got me so nervous I said pipeline.
Pipeline?
He said he was building it to Port Hueneme, didn't he?
Yes.
Well, then...
That's what I'm saying. In the movie, that's what he said. So... yes, there is a Port Hueneme, and there is a Point Magoo, and there's probably some place called Slobovich. I don't know, man, but there's all kinds of wacky places, and that's where it is. Now, while we do have these little commercial points of entry, San Francisco's got a very busy port. You know, if you go across the Bay Bridge and you see those big, huge, I don't know what they are. They're like cranes that lift cargo.
Well, that you're talking about George Lucas.
Yeah, that's what George Lucas was inspired by. Was it Lucas? Yeah, he was inspired by those things to create the Imperial Walkers.
You kidding?
No, I'm not kidding. He said every time he drove across the Bay Bridge and he looked at those big equipment moving cranes. They're huge, huge apparatus, and they or apparati. And
that one of the how you say more than one?
Yeah, you're like the one I heard the other day is stadii.
Well, what is that?
It's plural for stadium.
Oh, horse dung.
It's true. Stadia is plural for stadium.
Well, when he says it, I want to think it's horse dung.
In any event, so LA's harbor strike was concluded, or at least they have reached a tentative deal, so, you know, things and people and stuff and America can get back to, not that, you know, a lot of people were noticing it, but eventually you are going to notice that much commerce that has been suspended. You're going to notice this, you know, just the things that get delivered by way of ports, cars, anything that is hard goods that are made in other countries, these things are...
Yeah, but that's all stuff we import, man. We all just take it, throw it in the ocean.
Yeah, why don't they do that?
Why don't they do that? Because people have paid for it, man. They want to take delivery of this stuff and they want to sell it. What do you want me to say to you?
Well, I think they're making the point. This is all imported hardware and hard goods, right?
Yeah.
Well, why do we want that in our country? We are trying to narrow the trade deficit.
Well, that's not spoken like a true citizen of the world, now is it?
Wait a second. The people that are the free enterprise freaks, the conservatives, they're the ones that keep talking about foreign goods.
I think that what people who've got any brains at all, whether they're conservative or liberal, all they're really talking about is what we would call an equitable or an even playing terrain. Meaning, if I have to do this and that, then the Chinese should equally. Now, nothing comes into clearer relief and focus when it comes to that topic than the idea of climate change and what we need to do to keep it from happening.
So you do buy the whole idea of the climate?
Yes.
Of course he understands what... What do you mean climate?
He means climate change.
No, he said, would you...
I'm going to kill somebody, I swear to God.
Phil, I didn't know what he was saying.
Yes, you did. You're just... He's talking about climate change. Yes, I believe that there is climate change. Yes, I believe that there's climate change that was likely caused in some measure by humans. Yes, I believe that. However, the burden of correcting that problem cannot fall exclusively to the United States of America. I don't give a damn how big and bad China is. You understand? Now, this is where we get stupid. And this is why I say, it stares you right in the face. Unless somebody can convince me otherwise, it stares you right in the face and it says... This is an obvious thing. Why do you think it's red when it's blue? And I believe this is one of those topics. When we talk about the carbon emissions of industrialized nations, and we look at the garbage that is being spit, belched, puked into the air by India and China, just two countries, as an example, part of the big brick, the big brick pantheon, if you will, Brazil and Russia. And is it India or Israel? It's India and China.
I thought it was Israel.
I don't know, but it's the I stands for one of those countries. Probably India, because when we talk about those five countries, Brazil, now I forgot.
Brazil, Romania?
Not Romania, Russia, India.
And China.
China. We talk about five emerging second world, soon to be first world nations.
Now, tell people what second world means. I don't want you to belabor it, but...
Second world is an emerging nation. It's not third world in so far as we understand third world, which is that it is impoverished. There's high illiteracy. There is not widespread industrialization. There is most likely constant... epidemic or disease problems, epidemics of disease problems, that's a third world nation. Second world are nations that are beginning to lift themselves out of that and are emerging and are on the cusp of becoming first world. I would even say that China probably qualifies in some way as a first world nation, but not quite, because last I looked, every time they have an earthquake, like 50,000 people die, and I don't call that first world, but hey, I could be wrong.
What is that supposed to mean?
I don't think you're, I don't think you can credibly call yourself a first world country when you can't even absorb an earthquake without 50,000 people dying. How do you call yourself a first world country?
You can do a press release.
What do you mean, do a press release?
That's why you call yourself first world.
Do you understand what I'm talking, a press release?
Well, you could.
What, are you guys understanding what I'm saying? If you are a bona fide real player in the first world sense, if you are a badass, top of the lineup, heavy hitter, major league country, that's what we're talking about. That's what a first world country is. It's a major league country. Okay? Now, in my opinion, I go to the basics. I don't give a damn whether somebody... yes, literacy is important and medical care is important. All of these things are important. But let's just go to the basics. Let's talk about being able to take care of people in an emergency. Let's talk about, for instance, an earthquake. When an earthquake occurs in the United States of America, a serious, serious earthquake, thus far we have sustained in our evolved state, we sustain casualties, deaths in the hundreds. Maybe. We certainly do sustain injuries, but we are generally able to have the damage repaired, to bandage the wounds, to take care of those that need taking care of in relatively short order. We marshal our energies, we marshal our emergency services, and at that point where a society is at its lowest, where any society would be at its lowest, at the point of actual physical emergency and physical calamity, America, like most first world countries, responds quickly and with a minimum, I say a minimum, of loss of life. China doesn't make the grade. I'm sorry.
Well, Phil, earthquakes are worse over there.
Oh, what do you mean earthquakes are worse over there?
The buildings fall down, hello.
Yeah, the buildings are falling down.
Well, I wonder why the buildings are falling down. Because the freaking buildings are built like crap. Believe me, I've been there, man. I mean, when they get tired of building a building in China, when they run out of money, they just leave it there. I mean, you can drive by, I don't know how many construction sites I went by in China, and there were bricks, mortar, there was wood. My God, you probably even see the cement mixer still there. They just decided, well, can't build this one. Let's move on to another job. I mean, these cats are throwing up buildings and throwing up structures over there so fast. They're not built very substantially. They're certainly not earthquake proofed. And they're losing, when they have an earthquake, they're losing people by the tens of thousands. I don't give a damn what that is not first world. That's why...
Yeah, but did you see the Olympics?
That's a very... Did you see their Olympics? They had a man... They were defying gravity in their Olympics. They had people walking upside down. I don't know what you expect.
Well, I'll tell you something. They can do all kinds of magic tricks, you know.
No, I'm saying their Olympics made our Olympics look like... It looked like a kid's show in a barn. That's what it looked like.
Margaret, I don't give a damn if they had guys that were passing from this dimension to another dimension at their Olympic opening ceremonies. Any country can do that for a week. Oh, I got a break. See, you guys pissed me off so much, there's my engineer telling me I have to break.
Well, in China, they probably would have broke sooner, wouldn't they?
Yeah, see, gotcha.
Yeah, you got me. In China, man, now they're a first world country. They would have had their break at 14 like I was supposed to. We'll be right back. Phil Hendry Show.
Truth is our bitch.
Don't the Phil Hendry Show.
Hello, am I still on the air? I have no idea.
My wife's still on the air.
I'm not joking, Phil.
You're not joking. You're gonna believe this, folks.
Don't talk about me like I'm some sort of mental deficient like this Dickman. I said that when you talk down...
Do you mind if I get into the segment here and talk to my audience for just a second? Hold on.
Go ahead.
It's the Phil Hendry Show. Welcome, folks, back to the show, 877-876-PHIL. We've only had one guest tonight, and I was scheduled, to have Mr. Raj Fanin on, who is a businessman in the Valley and was going to be talking. He actually was supposed to be on last night talking about security or something. Is he scheduled tonight?
Get him on. I think he's...
Well, get him on. He can talk about this question of third world. Go ahead, Margaret.
I was saying the food, you know, you want to trivialize everything. Have you had tandoori chicken or haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Oh, here we go. That's the tone of voice where he goes, oh, I have to patronize the woman.
Margaret.
I have to patronize the woman. Have you had tandoori chicken?
Yes.
And you call India a third world country?
Wow. So,
No, no, not wow. Have you had the tandoori chicken? Phil, tandoori chicken is one of the most delicious dishes that it has ever been my pleasure to have. Now, you know I've eaten food all over the world. You know that, don't you?
Yes.
And as Frank likes to say, because he's a vulgar, filthy-minded, but I love him, he's just plain eaten all over the world.
Yeah, he's probably been eaten all over the world.
Why, you filthy... Ow! 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 Now, you have to... He had that coming.
You did, bud. You had it coming.
God!
So you think you're real hip with a line like that, huh? Say it again and watch what happens. This high heel, it'll get buried right up the... So Frank and I have traveled. I've had the tandoori chicken, and you're trying to tell me that India is a third world wasteland. Well, I'm sorry, I don't buy it.
Margaret, here's what I'm saying about India. I'm sorry that their tandoori chicken doesn't qualify them as first world.
Well, it shows what you know.
Yeah, I okay. But,
And that doesn't mean you know a lot. It means you know nothing. You know as much as that.
You're pointing to Bud?
No, I'm pointing to Robert. Yes, I'm pointing to Bud.
All right. As good as the tandoori chicken is, the Indian nation, I would not say is third world, because they have an enormous resources that they can marshal in the event of anything, whether it be an emergency, whether it be a war. India is a country with great potential wealth, and they can pull it together, but it takes them a long time. There's a lot of confusion. They don't yet know how to pull together what they got, man. They don't yet know how to quite organize that enormous and marvelous country that they have. India is an amazing country. It's an ancient country. It has informed Western thinking. See, this is one of the things that we forget. When we talk about how advanced we are here, there, or somewhere else, we are very advanced in the West when it comes to technology. But where we are advanced in technology, other parts of the world have advanced in other areas, in other ways. We can talk, for instance, about what we seem to claim is very important in the West. Well, if we think it's very important, then we wouldn't scoff at the advances that have been made in places like India and China when it comes to the spiritual life of the human being.
What do you mean? Like Buddha and stuff?
I would say that the approach to religion, to the approach to spiritual matters in the East is far more, it makes far more sense, is far more, I guess it's more user-friendly is the best way to say it.
Well, we're not talking about a game, Phil.
No, I know we're not talking about a game, but it's not so daunting and off-putting as some Western religions. I think that Eastern religions are far more advanced and far easier for people, the average person, to use and to create a better state for their lives with than the way the Western society has developed Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. I think Islam, Judaism, and Christianity are stiff and very uninteresting and uninspired religions compared to Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, even Hinduism.
Hinduism, the one where they got a guy with a bunch of... Yeah, that's the one I saw. They had an elephant had like 15 trunks. That's the stupidest thing.
You guys don't know what you're talking about, okay?
Well, the Shiva, the multi-armed god Shiva, which of course is what Robert Oppenheimer had referred to.
Yes. Now...
And excuse me, but in that statement, he talked about the god Shiva talking to an individual who he was reminding of his duty.
I understand that, Margaret.
I'm not done yet. And in reminding him of his duty, he achieved the multi-armed form and said, now something along the lines of, now I am death. Now I become death. That's it. Now I become death, the destroyer of worlds. I'm Margaret Gray. You filthy...
Oh, ow! Ow!
Why did you belch, bud?
Why do you let him do that?
I thought it was a good time to belch.
I heard what Robert Oppenheimer said, that I am now death, the destroyer of worlds. He was talking about the atom bomb.
Yes, he was quoting the god Shiva of the Hindu faith.
Fine, but when you put it that way, it doesn't make any more sense than any other religion to me. I'm talking about just the good old-fashioned, hey, are you a human being? Yeah, here's a way for you to have a spiritual life that makes sense. Thank you. You know, we're so off the... forget it.
Oh, what, are you going to get depressed?
Yeah, he's all depressed now.
Sure I'm depressed. We'll be right back. World famous Phil Hendry Show.
Now I become death, the destroyer of worlds. You dirty, stinking... Now I become death, the destroyer of worlds.
Phil Hendry.
You lousy crawling...
famous Phil Hendry Show.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that I read, and you know, the port of LA or the port, any city, every city and any city, one of the great treasures that we have is history, and we can even, you know, the history of our own city and the history of Los Angeles, because it's even though I was born in LA County, I wasn't born in LA City, I was born in Pasadena. I consider myself a Los Angeles, or I don't consider myself a Los Angelino, you know.
What's that?
That's what people from L.A., I guess, call themselves. I don't know. But I consider myself an inhabitant of the L.A. area, L.A. County, and somebody who grew up in the sphere of influence of L.A. But for whatever reason, I consider it my city.
Well, I don't think that's unusual. I think you get a lot of people from out of state or out of town. They don't understand what it is to come from this area, and they say... Well, you don't come from L.A., and they don't get it. They're stupid.
All right, well, I'm not going to call them stupid, okay? In any event, I was reading the other day about Skid Row. When I was a kid, my dad worked downtown L.A., and he used to eat his lunch...
In Skid Row?
No, he didn't eat in Skid Row.
Well, where did he eat?
He used to eat at these places downtown, like Felipe's, Little Joe's, places that were near Chinatown, near downtown, near some of the offices. You know, we talk about downtown L.A., you're talking about the City Hall, you're talking about the courthouses and places like that, the L.A. Times. It's a business area. It's not really all that fancy. And even today, after they've encouraged people to turn it into a residential area, there's very few people, I think. There's the Loft District, and there's some of the high-rises that they have down there, Bunker Hill or whatever.
What Bunker Hill?
Bunker Hill is the name of a hill that was in L.A. that they turned into, I think they've built a couple of apartments there. I don't know. I haven't been downtown in a long time. But the point I'm trying to make here is that there was Skid Row. And Skid Row was an area that you'd eventually, it's called the Central City District or the Central City Business District now, technically. But it was an area that you knew you were in. You get a little bit south of City Hall, you're heading toward the Warehouse District, and there was this area of streets you knew was really a desolation row of some kind. It was alcoholics and these run-down, fleabag-looking hotels and these bars that you'd see the guys hanging around. And that's what I remember as a kid. And I found out, I said, you know, how come the Skid Row of L.A. developed there? First of all, you know what a Skid Row is?
You were saying to Dan, it's about lumber.
It's something that lumberjacks used to slide the huge logs
that they squeezed off.
Get out of here.
Oh, come on.
Get out of here. Go on, get out.
No, I'm done making a joke.
Get out. Huge logs they squeezed off.
They was begging for me to say that.
No, bud, you're an idiot. Getting back, the term Skid Row originated in Seattle, believe it or not, where a place where they had these tracks that the logs and the timber that the lumberjacks sawed and, you know, cut down, they'd slide them down these chutes that were skid rows, literally. And so this is where the lumberjacks worked. And so where these skid rows were, these places where the timber that had been cut down was slid so that they could further either plane it and turn it into refined pieces of lumber or do whatever they were going to do with it. This is also where hotels, where bars, and where places that catered to the needs of men, young men, you know, guys, working men, these are these places that would spring up. Bordellos, you know.
Yeah, like a whorehouse.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of them, you know. This is, we're talking about Seattle in the 19th century. There wasn't a whole hell of a lot. There weren't any, they had laws, but they sure as hell didn't have any laws against guys enjoying themselves because they had a lot of guys up there working on all kinds of stuff. The last thing they would do, why don't we make it really inhospitable and really a drag for guys to come up here and work?
Well, my God, they could at least have...
Margaret. Anyway, so... So these areas became areas where there were bars, there were hotels, places where these lumberjacks would go after they finished working. So they called, so Skid Row, which is this place, as I said, where this lumber was, or this timber was sent to be worked on, Skid Row began to take on the meaning of a place where there's a lot of rundown hotels and a lot of bars and a lot of guys that are drunk and a lot of guys that are, you know, doing stuff maybe they shouldn't do. And hence we got our Skid Row here in L.A. But I was finding out that Skid Row in Los Angeles... Because L.A. was an agricultural town. It was an agricultural town. That's what the railroad here was servicing. That's what the that's why people came to this town by way of railroad. They were either delivering agricultural products or they were workers that were coming into town to work on the farms and work in the agricultural industry. And so... Downtown L.A., where the rails and the railroad stations were, would, you know, be a place where all of these single guys that were farm workers and agricultural workers would get off the train, and the first thing they're looking for is a place to stay, a place to drink, a place to socialize or whatever. And so right off of the rail sidings, downtown L.A. sprang up Skid Row. And then later, when the military was coming through town for World War II, lots of guys coming into town. Boom.
Now, you were talking about something that's far more relevant, because what you're talking about now is really people are just, like, who cares?
I care. That's who cares.
Well, but, Phil, I mean, you've got...
I care. That's who cares, okay?
But you were talking about gays.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's true, you know.
Can we come back in now?
Shut up.
You don't talk about gay people.
What, do you got to call Mr. Hall and complain?
Maybe.
Nothing in the history of America has furthered the growth, the interaction, the integration, the vitality of the gay community. Nothing. And this is the irony. Nothing has promoted the political sophistication, growth, interaction, and community of gay people in this country more than, believe it or not, the military.
Now, that I find hard to believe.
Well, it is true. It is true. The military, even though the military for years and years and years and years didn't allow gay people, it was the military that promoted the sophistication and the growth and the viability of the gay community. Because think about it. World War II, what was that? It's a war. And who needs to go into the war? Guys. And guys have to go places to be in the army to go off to the war. And guess what those places were? They were big cities. And guess what else happened? Lots of guys show up and a lot of guys suddenly go, hi, I'm gay. Are you? Yes. They start recognizing each other and realizing, geez, there's a whole bunch of gay guys like me.
And so you're saying what?
So I'm telling you that World War II especially was really a defining moment in the history of gay people in the United States, especially gay men, because it was during World War II that so many of them met each other, recognized that they had something in common in terms of their sexual orientation. When the war ended and these guys were out of the military, they're on their way back to New York or back to San Francisco or back to Los Angeles or back to these communities that they became aware of either because they were there or because they talked to and met other people like themselves in the military who told them about the communities that they came from. So it was World War II that was a huge milestone in the cohesion of gay people politically, Because think about it, right after World War II, gay rights, you know, we think about Stonewall, which was 1969, but it was going on in the 50s all the way on into the early 60s. It was bound to happen sooner or later. And it's one of the greatest ironies of history, especially in this country, that the military, which for so many years shunned gay people, and of course there's no way you're going to keep gay people from serving in the military if they want to. And a lot of people are going to say, well, that's because there's a lot of guys, and gee, and well, you know, okay, but let me ask you a question. You know, a lot of those guys lost their lives in the war, and do you want to go find their names on that Vietnam War Memorial or wherever there are war memorials and say, oh, he's gay, I think I need to take his name off of that. I think I'll scratch his name off of there. I don't think so. I don't think there's anybody with that kind of guts. But the fact is, that's the irony, and that's what happened, and I think it's interesting, you know.
Well, you mentioned the Eddie aircraft.
Yeah, I told that story. It's a really great book. I recommend you read it. It's called Gay Metropolis, and it's available now in paperback. I don't know whether it is or not. All right.
Is it?
What are you doing back in here?
Well, we thought it was okay. We didn't say nothing.
Well, okay.
I want to talk about the gays and everything.
Yeah, I'll bet you did.
We don't want you talking about it because you'll turn it into some stupid joke.
No, I wasn't. I was going to talk about Mr. Henry. What are you saying?
Oh, just shut up, bud. I don't even know what you're talking about half the time. It's just a bunch of noise, okay? All right. Our website, philhenryshow.com, philhenryshow.com. Get a backstage pass. And if you're online and you go to Tweebler, as Bobby calls it, or Tweener, as her husband Steve calls it, but the rest of us call it Twitter, you can find us at twitter.com/realphilhendry. Margaret is there. She's at twitter.com/MargaretGray. Bud Dickman is there. Bud, what's your handle?
twitter.com/TheBudDickman.
The Bud Dickman. And then I'm there, Real Phil Hendry. And then, of course, we're on Facebook.
You already said your name.
Well, I said it twice, okay?
God.
He's allowed to. He's the host.
Whatever.
Well, Margaret, you know I am the host. I'm going to say my name twice. It's just going to have to live with it, okay?
When do I get to do a podcast? That's what I want to know.
Watch it.
Well,
watch it. We're also at Facebook, facebook.com/ Phil Hendry Fans, PHANS. So you can join us over there. And you can like our Facebook fan page and junk like that. And I'm at Instagram, Real Phil Hendry at Instagram, although Instagram's kind of squirrely, isn't it?
I don't know.
Anyway, you can see us over there. We'll be right back with more final segment of the world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
Truth is our bitch. The Phil Hendry Show.
Well, here's a story that, you know, is just, and I always try to put myself in the shoes of the people that are in the midst of any particular story that we may be reading, if it's one that is going to outrage you and one that's already pissed me off. So I always try to put myself in the shoes of people involved in these stories, but nonetheless, it's a story that makes me angry. I don't even know if anybody out there listening to what I'm about to read to you is going to be angry, but it's one that made me angry. The New York Post, you know, this man that was pushed onto a subway track allegedly after a fight, and a photograph was taken by someone. The New York Post put this on the front page, a picture of a man about to be killed by an oncoming subway train. The New York Post front page picture of a man about to be killed by an oncoming subway train. Now, the Post printing that picture doesn't bother me. The Post is a newspaper. And if ever there is news, which is the intersection of what's important and what is interesting, this is news because it is the story of the human race. It's the story of the human animal in the urban jungle. It's the story of who and what we are and what we've become in some instances in the middle of this pressure-packed environment we've created called the city. Now, you know, not too long ago, last week, we had a cop putting shoes on the feet of a homeless man. Cops, they see just about the most horrific stuff you could possibly see. Cops have seen it all. They've seen every kind of debauchery, every kind of violence, every kind of depravity cops have seen. And here is this cop putting shoes on a man's feet. Now we get to the average man and woman of America, maybe of the world, but certainly of New York. The victim was thrown onto the tracks during a fight on Monday with a deranged man in a Manhattan subway station. He then staggered to his feet and tried but failed to get out of the way of the train, which killed him in full view of a crowd of passengers. One of those bystanders was a freelance photographer from the Post who managed to take a series of photos, including the one occupying the whole front page on Tuesday under the headline, "This Man is About to Die." Now, you got these pictures, the New York Post, and you have a man who is standing there with a camera, and I'm reminded of the story I told you, which is captured on film, and you can see it, and you can you know, see the proof in the pudding. I'm reminded of the story I told you of a man in a similar situation taking pictures from the Golden Gate Bridge, and he even had a photograph of a young woman that was about to jump, but that guy wasn't so busy taking his pictures that he didn't sling that camera over his shoulder and reach down with one arm and pull that girl off of that railing and to safety, a girl who was about to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. It's captured in a film called The Bridge. You can watch it and you can see the proof for yourself. Now that is a human being, a guy that's going to take his pictures, even record the moment of a woman's terrible depression and God knows anxiety and confusion, and then reach down. And you can see this man because it's captured by way of a film camera that is several hundred yards away from a vantage point away from the bridge. You see him reach down with his big arm, a visitor from Pennsylvania, a man who was in San Francisco looking at the sights, reaching down. He pulls this girl up with one arm and off of the bridge. But this guy with the Post, he wasn't able to do that. He wasn't able to do that, not because he wasn't physically able to do that. I don't know, but I'm suspecting he wasn't able to do it because he just wasn't able as... He's not the type of human being that's capable of that. In a video report of the story, the Post appeared to suggest the picture and two others in a double-page spread inside the newspaper were just unintentional byproducts of the photographer's rescue attempt. Not being strong enough to physically lift the victim himself, the photographer used the only resources available to him and began rapidly flashing his camera to signal the train conductor to stop. An absolute lie by the New York Post. That's where I have a problem. Readers quickly slammed the Post photographer and editors for what they saw as a callous attitude to the tragedy. Wow, enough time to take a few pictures? Why didn't the person help? How many pictures did they take? 3, 4? Nobody tried to help? Not one person? Wrote another female reader, there aren't any real men in New York City. The Atlantic Wire website joined the outcry. There's one big question about today's intense cover of the New York Post. Why didn't anyone help him? If there's enough time to capture a dying man's last moments before getting hit by an oncoming train, couldn't the photographer have lent a hand? In the Post, the photographer R. Umar Abbasi said he had used his camera principally to warn the approaching train driver. I just started running, hoping that the driver could see my flash, he said. The explanation didn't convince critics on Twitter. Claims he was using his camera's flash to catch a conductor's attention, tweeted Eleanor Commissar, but results seems a tad too well composed. Looked like, in other words, you were framing that picture pretty good there, sir. It's sickening. Why on earth would the New York Post put this on their cover? This is a guy that's trying to make himself out to be a hero. The New York Post is trying to make this guy out to be some kind of a hero, trying to save a man's life. But, oh yeah, just coincidentally, I happen to get some really cool shots. Whoever took the picture that's on the cover, the New York Post should be arrested for not helping the dude that got killed, one wrote. Please boycott the New York Post for putting the final moments of the subway victim killed after being pushed in New York City. It's disgusting, wrote another woman. On its own Twitter feed, the Post flagged its controversial story. Shocking video and pic. Dad pushed to death by madman in Times Square subway station. As the uproar grew, the New York Times, which styles itself as the paper that runs only the news that's fit to print, ran an image of the horrific Post front page on its website and invited reader response. The debate was more civil than the insult-laden Post comments section, but opinions were similarly harsh. Several contributors accused the Times of fanning the publicity flames. Neither the Post or the Times should have shown this picture, but above all, shame on the photographer. Had he only reached out a hand, this man may have had a chance of survival. This is an ethical line that should not have been crossed. Sleazy wrote another, "The demise of journalism is no more prevalent than this. We have replaced news for sensationalism. The Times is just as guilty as the Post, even if it's using the picture for discussion of journalistic integrity." Police said on Tuesday they were holding a person of interest in the alleged crime, but had not yet pressed charges. So that's the story there. Morning glory, as my mother used to say. We'll be back tomorrow night. Hate to leave you with a bummer, you know.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Well, I can kick your ass back out again, bud. We'll be back, tomorrow night. Tonight at 10 o'clock here on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. Don't forget to go to our website, philhendryshow.com, and get yourself a backstage pass. And when you do get that backstage pass, you are going to be, you're going to be treated to thousands of hours of downloadable materials, as well as our video cast, as well as our video cast archive, as well as our daily podcast, etc. And, of course, you're going to get your free downloads, too, with 1 month, one free download, 6 months, three, and a year, five. The world-famous Phil Hendry Show. Until tonight, let that be a lesson to you.
Phil Hendry.